Stephen Mayne is the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist. He joins us every week, or every fortnight actually, to talk about business and what's happening and trying to read the tea leaves, really, and explain, clear the mist over some of these big deals that go down. And of course, it's Opus Prime that we're all thinking about this morning. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Deborah. How are you?
Good, thank you. Opus Prime is one of the more remarkable stories of the week. Can you background us exactly on where we are with what's happened there?
Okay, well, in very round terms, 1,200 Australians, mainly wealthy sort of investment professionals, company directors, criminal lawyers, these types, have about $2 billion invested in shares funded by Opus Prime, which had lent about $1.2 billion to support these shares. And over the last 4 or 5 months, the collective value of the portfolio has tanked, and a number of prominent clients have got into financial troubles. And Opus Prime has gone into receivership, and the absolute shock for all of the clients, or most of the clients of Opus Prime, has been that they didn't actually own the shares. The shares were owned by the banks, ANZ and Merrill Lynch, and even if they only had a minor loan over those shares, these other clients will have to fund the losses of the clients who couldn't meet their margin calls.
Now, what's amazing is that what's happened is that very high-risk share-buying manoeuvres, including one, it seems, involving Chris Murphy, the Sydney barrister, where he had borrowed a large amount of money to buy a lot of shares, were all together in the same pool with people who had bought shares with completely solid money.
That's right. It's the collective sharing of the loss, which is completely different from any other broking collapse, that you can be as strong and as good as you like, but you're out of there. So,
Do you think that people should have been told that they were in the same pool with the likes of people who were prepared to take enormous risks in life, gamblers actually?
Well, that's right. Well, it supposedly is in the fine print of the contracts. But I've been playing the market. I've had margin loans for 15 years, and I'd never heard of this situation, and I haven't come across a client of Opus who's in the press yet who said they were aware of this. So I think there's undoubtedly going to be some legal action about whether clients were properly advised of the situation. But the caravan's moved on almost from that, and literally the shares are being liquidated. Dozens of stocks on the stock market are being affected. There's been more than 10 that have been suspended from trading because individual directors or substantial shareholders have lost control of their shares, and people don't know what's going to happen to the shares because there's a fire sale going on. And this is completely unprecedented. And then, of course, you have the dramatic evidence given before the federal court last Friday in Melbourne, which was that the managing director and one of the co-founders, Laurie Amini, had been directing his staff to do round-robin share transactions, to change figures in various accounts, to not trigger margin calls, to place shares from one account to another account, basically attempting to cover up for six supposedly favoured clients. So six wealthy clients who Laurie Amini didn't want to actually cop the direct margin call were literally having their accounts falsified so that the margin calls weren't actually placed. And the biggest player in this game, if you believe all the press reports, is Chris Murphy, who according to the courts, what was said by ASIC last week, is the client who has $145 million exposure. Now, Chris Murphy's position is, I don't know what's been going on with my portfolio, and I'd be a lot better off if ANZ and Opus had actually given me margin calls earlier, and I've never had a margin call. So he's basically putting up his hands and saying, don't blame me, blame the banks.
But he sold a lot of shares last week. Don't I remember stories about Mr. Murphy selling $25 million worth of shares last week or the week before and saying that it wasn't as a result of a margin call?
That's correct. He sold 15.5 million shares in Challenger Financial Group. And the history there is that Chris Murphy's long been an associate of the Packer family and the Packer family's supporters. He spent the weekend with Alan Jones, the shock jock, who's obviously long been very close to the Packers. And Challenger Financial Group is the old CPH Investments, which was the old Packer Family Investment Vehicle, and the Packer Family still owns 20% of it today. But Challenger Financial Services Group share prices tanked from $6 to $1.70 over the last 4 or 5 months. And clearly, Chris Murphy, who's one of the substantial shareholders, was facing financial pressure and was clearly financed into that position in part by Opus Prime. Now, his position, his publicly stated position at the time of the sale was that he was just rebalancing his portfolio and he did not receive any formal margin call. And that is a possible explanation, because we're now being told that the managing director of Opus was shuffling shares around and changing loan valuation ratios to protect clients from actually receiving margin calls. But where the situation gets a bit more interesting is that Chris Murphy and Laurie Amini appear to have a separate business relationship, which is they're common directors of a company called Sarah Brown. They each own control 10 shares in that. The Sarah Brown Proprietary Limited is registered to Chris Murphy's office. So that raises a whole series of other questions of what is the exact nature of the relationship here? Why wasn't Chris Murphy given his margin calls earlier? Who said what to who? And this will obviously be a matter for the ASIC investigators and everyone else who've taken a keen interest in this very, very dramatic story.
There's also a touch of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous about it as well. Chris Merritt and John Lyons have got a terrific story on the front of The Australian today, where they paint a picture of Chris Murphy's apartment in Walsh Bay having been transformed into a private trading room with spectacular 180-degree view of Sydney Harbour and the nearby bridge, surrounded his desk with three huge computer screens. And they say, as rock music blared, Mr. Murphy turned his back on the sweeping view and would check share prices and place buy and sell orders. He apparently even had a laptop secured to his treadmill. I mean, was he practicing as a barrister, or had he basically given that up and he was now making money on the stock market?
Well, I mean, I think Chris has always been a high-profile punter. I mean, back in the 1980s, he was said at one point to have been the largest punter on Sydney racetracks. He still practices. He still runs his legal practice. I mean, he's represented some of the alleged terror suspects in Sydney. So he still keeps his hand in with that. But obviously, his major focus in recent years has been as a share market investor. There's also been some press reports, reputable columnists writing that his investment vehicle, which is called Cardiac Jolt, quite appropriately, also manages money for other people. And one name that's been mentioned in the press is Russell Crowe. And I think they have a joint, have been seen at the footy together following Souths and things like that. But I think the majority of the money in Cardiac Jolt, I think, is clearly controlled by Chris Murphy, and he's obviously got a major personal interest in it. But there may be some third-party money in there as well. And this is where it gets very interesting, because a lot of very powerful, some colourful, interesting, connected people are going to have to share collectively the losses that Murphy and some other prominent clients have clearly racked up. And so there's going to be a lot of finger pointing here as to who's to blame. And Murphy's already positioning himself to say, they never told me, I'd be a lot better off if their margin called me, the bank didn't let me know, I don't know what's going on with my portfolio, and is clearly attempting to distance himself. And equally, there's another fascinating story in the press today that Babcock and Brown, which is associated with the other high-profile broker, which has almost collapsed, Tricom, that Tricom was able to refinance more than $60 million worth of shares out of the Opus portfolio in special off-market transactions last Friday.
I hate to say it, but gee, that's a pretty bit of timing.
Well, the way this will work is that the old preferential payments argument is that, and we saw it with things like HIH, and it's a common thing when companies are in trouble, is people who were the last to get to the exit, whether they had any information. And what's interesting about the way that Tricom refinanced a lot of Opus large shares last week was that ANZ Bank is the major banker to both Tricom and Opus. Now, ANZ Bank is saying, look, there was no information. These were just rigi-dig normal transactions. But I think you'll see the regulators crawling all over that element of this controversy as well. And of course, there's going to be, I mean, this has really got it all. It's got everything from stock lending to hedge funds. It's got lifestyle excesses. I mean, Laurie Amini, said to be a big punter, is reported to have visited the Hefner mansion in the US. last year.
God, it's even got Playboy bunnies.
That's right. You know, so it's got it all. I mean, the Opus has been a major sponsor of all sorts of different motorsport ventures. They've been splashing out money on that. The owner owns a bit of horse flesh himself, Laurie Amini. And the Melbourne papers today are talking about clients with connections to Tony Mockbell and them not being happy. So, yes, this story, I think someone will write a very good book one day on the collapse of Opus. And I think this will probably end up being the low water mark or high water mark on the excesses of the noughties. We talk about the excesses of the 1980s and all those entrepreneurs. I think the way the whole Opus empire was structured, which is fast lifestyles and lending money on any stock on the stock market, no matter what it is, not very good disclosure, and stock lending and all these sorts of things, and hedge funds and excessive margin loans, etc., it will become seen as the totemic symbol of all that was wrong in the last 3 or 4 year crazy credit boom that we've had.
You're listening to Stephen Mayne, who is the founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist, someone who monitors these moves very closely. You were watching, I'm sure, Four Corners last night, that powerful attack on bank lending practices. What did you make of it?
Well, I thought it was a very, very powerful a powerful attack. I thought it was particularly interesting the way that that GE, which is one of the second or third biggest company in the world, big American conglomerate, was pretty much named as being the lender and the provider of the credit card services for a lot of Australians who are in financial strife. And I think the way they kneaded together refugees receiving loans that they shouldn't, plus former bank managers talking about being given incentive payments based on the number of loans and connections to the poverty indexes that they measure. I thought it was just a very powerful attack on finance, and it was very on the financing culture in Australia, the you know, lend it no matter what sort of culture. And Wayne Swan on Late Line also last night was quite strong in saying that we must have a strong response to this. So I think that, again, the sort of the anything-goes credit culture of the last few years is over. The Howard government really did very little about bank excess and just general credit excesses. I mean, we've all borrowed. A lot of people have borrowed too much, and the party's just been going on for a long time. So I think with the change of government, we will see quite a strong regulatory backlash on things like lending practices and the way they've nationalised things like margin lending and mortgage broking and other credit parts of the credit industry in that COAG meeting last week. I think was an important first step where you'll see much firmer federal regulation on things such as lending practices, because some of what was revealed last night was pretty horrifying, I think you've got to say.
Yeah, now, just I guess this touches back on the Opus Prime subject in a way. Solomon Liu has making a bid for Just Jeans. Just was one of the companies, I think, affected by the Opus Prime. But what does it tell you about Solomon Liu?
Well, Solly Liu, for his entire adult life, has been a wheeler, dealer, trader in retail stocks. You go back to his most important and most successful play, which was the original $33 million investment in Myer, the independent Myer Emporium, as it was then, back in 1983, and which he then parlayed into a combined stake in Coles Myer when it merged 2 years later. Now, I think Solly successfully called the top of the market last year when he collected more than $1 billion selling his stake in Coles Myer to Wesfarmers as part of the takeover. And retail stocks, many of them have halved in the last 4 or 5 months. A lot of investors are concerned that overly debt-burdened Australians won't be able to continue signing up for the GE credit cards and putting things on the card to fund consumption anymore with rising interest rates and housing corrections and things like that. So retail prices have pretty much halved, and Just Group is one that's almost halved. And so Solly's come along yesterday and offered $900 million to take over Just Group, and I think there's probably a fair chance it will succeed. So some people are observing and saying Solly's, you know, got a great record of picking tops and bottoms, and if Solly thinks that now's a good time to get back into retail stocks, then maybe he's actually calling the bottom for the whole market.
Be interesting to see. Now, I note also that you're keeping a bit of an eye on Morrissey Yemma and his ideas for curbing donations to political parties.
Well, I think it is quite amazing that Australia's probably got, at the moment, the slackest disclosure laws in the world, that any foreigner can donate. There's no limit on the amount that you can donate. You don't have to disclose it for, in some cases, you can wait 21 months or 20 months before you actually disclose the amount that has been given. And you can hide figures by doing $10,000 in eight different states and territories and federally, and you don't have to disclose that. And obviously with Wollongong, we've seen a major shock to the system, and Kevin Rudd's come out with some fairly substantial reforms, which is banning foreign donations, similar to the US. But I was amazed to see that Maurice Yemma wants to push on with a complete, utter and total ban on donations and to only have publicly funded election campaigns in New South Wales. Now, we already do have public funding of election campaigns federally and in most states. I mean, in federally, you get $2.10 per vote, so which costs the taxpayers $30 million. So I'm presuming that in having a complete ban on all donations, you would then have to have a substantial increase in public funding of elections in New South Wales, maybe up to $3 or $4 a vote, if you were to recreate the level of spending we've seen in the past. So, from one extreme to the other, from anything goes system to Maurice Yemma says, I want to totally ban all donations, full stop, which is a pretty aggressive response to, I guess, what is a pretty awful situation in Wollongong.
Thank you very much, Stephen.
Thanks,
we'll talk
Sarah.
Again in a couple of weeks. Stephen Mayne there, founder of crikey.com.au and a shareholder activist.